Chapter 4. The Moat Around the Castle. The hour of birth, their only time in college, they were content with their precocious knowledge, to know their station and be right forever. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 1. 1. Human Natural Resources. Google's former CEO, Eric Schmidt, credits Hal Varian's early examination of the firm's ad auctions with providing the eureka moment that clarified the true nature of Google's business. All of a sudden, we realized we were in the auction business. Larry Page is credited with a very different and far more profound answer to the question, "What is Google?" Douglas Edwards recounts a 2001 session with the founders that probed their answers to that precise query. It was Page who ruminated, "If we did have a category, it would be personal information. The places you've seen. Communications. Sensors are really cheap. Storage is cheap. Cameras are cheap. People will generate enormous amounts of data. Everything you've ever heard or seen or experienced will become searchable. Your whole life will be searchable." Page's vision perfectly reflects the history of capitalism, marked by taking things that live outside the market sphere and declaring their new life as market commodities. In historian Carl Polanyi's 1944 grand narrative of the Great Transformation to a self-regulating market economy, he described the origins of this translation process in three astonishing and crucial mental inventions that he called commodity functions. The first was that human life could be subordinated to market dynamics and reborn as labor to be bought and sold. The second was that nature could be translated into the market and reborn as land or real estate. The third was that exchange could be reborn as money. Nearly 80 years earlier, Karl Marx had described the taking of lands and natural resources as the original Big Bang that ignited modern capital formation, calling it primitive accumulation. The philosopher Hannah Arendt complicated both Polanyi's and Marx's notion. She observed that primitive accumulation wasn't just a one-time primal explosion that gave birth to capitalism. Rather, it is a recurring phase and a repeating cycle as more aspects of the social and natural world are subordinated to the market dynamic. Marx's original sin of simple robbery, she wrote, had eventually to be repeated lest the motor of capital accumulation suddenly die down. In our time of pro-market ideology and practice, this cycle has become so pervasive that we eventually fail to notice its audacity or contest its claims. For example, you can now purchase human blood and organs, someone to have your baby or stand in line for you or hold a public parking space, a person to comfort you in your grief, and the right to kill an endangered animal. The list grows longer each day. Social theorist David Harvey builds on Arendt's insight with his notion of accumulation by dispossession. What accumulation by dispossession does is to release a set of assets at very low, and in some instances zero, cost. Over-accumulated capital can seize hold of such assets and immediately turn them to profitable use. He adds that entrepreneurs who are determined to join the system and enjoy the benefits of capital accumulation are often the ones who drive this process of dispossession into new, undefended territories. Page grasped that human experience could be Google's virgin wood, that it could be extracted at no extra cost online and at very low cost out in the real world, where sensors are really cheap. Once extracted, it is rendered as behavioral data, producing a surplus that forms the basis of a wholly new class of market exchange. Surveillance capitalism originates in this act of digital dispossession, brought to life by the impatience of over-accumulated investment and two entrepreneurs who wanted to join the system. This is the lever that moved Google's world and shifted it toward profit. Today's owners of surveillance capital have declared a fourth functional commodity expropriated from the experiential realities of human beings, whose bodies, thoughts, and feelings are as virgin and blameless as nature's once plentiful meadows and forests before they fell to the market dynamic. In this new logic, human experience is subjugated to surveillance capitalism's market mechanisms and reborn as behavior. These behaviors are rendered into data, ready to take their place in a numberless queue that feeds the machines for fabrication into predictions and eventual exchange in the new behavioral futures markets. The commodification of behavior under surveillance capitalism pivots us toward a societal future in which market power is protected by moats of secrecy, indecipherability, and expertise. Even when knowledge derived from our behavior is fed back to us as a quid pro quo for participation, as in the case of so-called personalization, parallel secret operations pursue the conversion of surplus into sales that point far beyond our interests. We have no formal control because we are not essential to this market action. In this future, we are exiles from our own behavior, denied access to or control over knowledge derived from its dispossession by others for others. Knowledge, authority, and power rest with surveillance capital, for which we are merely human natural resources. We are the native peoples now whose tacit claims to self-determination have vanished from the maps of our own experience. Digital dispossession is not an episode, but a continuous coordination of action, material, and technique, not a wave, but the tide itself. Google's leaders understood from the start that their success would require continuous and pervasive fortifications designed to defend their repetitive sin from contest and constraint. They did not want to be bound by the disciplines typically imposed by the private market realm of corporate governance or the democratic realm of law. In order for them to assert and exploit their freedom, democracy would have to be kept at bay. How did they get away with it? It is an important question that we will return to throughout this book. One set of answers depends on understanding the conditions of existence that create and sustain demand for surveillance capitalism's services. This theme was summarized in Chapter 2's discussion of the collision. A second set of answers depends upon a clear grasp of surveillance capitalism's basic mechanisms and laws of motion. This exploration has begun and will continue through Part 2. A third set of answers requires an appreciation of the political and cultural circumstances and strategies that advanced surveillance capitalism's claims and protected them from fatal challenge. It is this third domain that we pursue in the sections that follow. No single element is likely to have done the job, but together, a convergence of political circumstances and proactive strategies helped enrich the habitat in which this mutation could root and flourish. These include 1. The relentless pursuit and defense of the founder's freedom through corporate control and its insistence on the right to lawless space. 2. The shelter of specific historical circumstances, including the policies and juridical orientation of the neoliberal paradigm, and the state's urgent interest in the emerging capabilities of behavioral surplus analysis and prediction in the aftermath of the September 2001 terror attacks. And 3, the intentional construction of fortifications in the worlds of politics and culture, designed to protect the kingdom and deflect any close scrutiny of its practices. 2. The Cry Freedom Strategy. One way that Google's founders institutionalized their freedom was through an unusual structure of corporate governance that gave them absolute control over their company. Page and Brin were the first to introduce a dual-class share structure to the tech sector with Google's 2004 public offering. The two would control the superclass B voting stock, shares that each carried 10 votes, as compared to the A class of shares, which each carried only one vote. This arrangement inoculated Page and Brin from market and investor pressures, as Page wrote in the founder's letter issued with the IPO. In the transition to public ownership, we have set up a corporate structure that will make it harder for outside parties to take over or influence Google. The main effect of this structure is likely to leave our team, especially Sergey and me, with increasingly significant control over the company's decisions and fate as Google shares change hands. In the absence of standard checks and balances, the public was asked to simply trust the founders. Schmidt would voice this theme on their behalf whenever challenged on the subject. For example, at the Cato Institute in December 2014, Schmidt was asked about the possibility of abuse of power at Google. He simply assured the audience of the continuity of the firm's dynastic line. Page had succeeded Schmidt as CEO in 2011, and the current leaders would handpick future leaders. "We're fine with Larry. Same circus, same clowns. It's the same people. All of us who built Google have the same view, and I am sure our successors will have the same view." By that year, Page and Brin had a 56% majority vote, which they used to impose a new tri-class share structure, adding a C-class of zero voting rights stock. As Bloomberg Businessweek observed, the neutered C shares ensure Page and Brin retain control far into the future. By 2017, Brin and Page controlled 83% of the super voting class B shares, which translated into 51% of the voting power. Many Silicon Valley founders followed Google's lead. By 2015, 15% of IPOs were introduced with a dual-class structure, compared to 1% in 2005, and more than half of those were for technology companies. Most significantly, Facebook's 2012 IPO featured a two-tiered stock structure that left founder Mark Zuckerberg in control of voting rights. The company then issued non-voting Class C shares in 2016, solidifying Zuckerberg's personal control over every decision. While financial scholars and investors debated the consequences of these share structures, absolute corporate control enabled the Google and Facebook founders to aggressively pursue acquisitions, establishing an arms race in two critical arenas. State-of-the-art manufacturing depended on machine intelligence, compelling Google and later Facebook to acquire companies and talent representing its disciplines: facial recognition, deep learning, augmented reality, and more. But machines are only as smart as the volume of their diet allows. Thus, Google and Facebook vied to become the ubiquitous net positioned to capture the swarming schools of behavioral surplus flowing from every computer-mediated direction. To this end, the founders paid outsized premiums for their chance to corner behavioral surplus through acquisitions of an ever-expanding roster of key supply routes. In 2006, for example, just 2 years after its IPO, Google paid $1.65 billion for a one-and-a-half-year-old startup that had never made any money and was besieged by copyright infringement laws: YouTube. While the move was called crazy and the company was criticized for the outsized price tag, Schmidt went on the offensive, freely admitting that Google had paid a $1 billion premium for the video sharing site, though saying little about why. By 2009, a canny Forrester Research media analyst had unpacked the mystery. "It actually becomes worth the additional value because Google can tie all of its advertising expertise and search traffic into YouTube. It ensures that these millions and millions of viewers are coming to a Google-owned site rather than someone else's site. As a loss leader goes, if it never makes its money back, it's still going to be worth it." Facebook's Zuckerberg pursued the same strategies, paying astronomical prices for a fast and furious parade of typically unprofitable startups, like virtual reality firm Oculus, $2 billion, and the messaging application WhatsApp, $19 billion, thus ensuring Facebook's ownership of the gargantuan flows of human behavior that would pour through these pipes. Consistent with the extraction imperative, Zuckerberg told investors that he would not consider driving revenue until the service reaches billions of users. As one tech journalist put it, "There's no real need for Zuckerberg to chat with the board. There's no way for shareholders to check Zuckerberg's antics." It's worth noting that an understanding of this logic of accumulation would have usefully contributed to the EU Commission's deliberations on the WhatsApp acquisition, which was permitted based on assurances that data flows from the two businesses would remain separate. The Commission would discover later that the extraction imperative and its necessary of economies of scale in supply operations compel the integration of surplus flows in the quest for better prediction products. Google's founders constructed a corporate form that gave them absolute control in the market sphere, and they also pursued freedom in the public sphere. A key element of Google's freedom strategy was its ability to discern, construct, and stake its claim to unprecedented social territories that were not yet subject to law. Cyberspace is an important character in this drama, celebrated on the first page of Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen's book on the digital age. The online world is not truly bound by terrestrial laws. It's the world's largest ungoverned space. They celebrate their claim to operational spaces beyond the reach of political institutions. The 21st century equivalent of the Dark Continents that drew 19th century European speculators to their shores. Hannah Arendt's examination of British capitalists' export of overaccumulated capital to Asia and Africa in the mid-19th century helps to develop this analogy. Here in backward regions, without industries and political organizations, where violence was given more latitude than in any Western country, these so-called laws of capitalism were actually allowed to create realities. The secret of the new happy fulfillment was precisely that economic laws no longer stood in the way of the greed of the owning classes. This kind of lawlessness has been a critical success factor in the short history of surveillance capitalism. Schmidt, Brin, and Page have ardently defended their right to freedom from law, even as Google grew to become what is arguably the world's most powerful corporation. Their efforts have been marked by a few consistent themes. That technology companies such as Google move faster than the state's ability to understand or follow. That any attempts to intervene or constrain are therefore fated to be ill-conceived and stupid. That regulation is always a negative force that impedes innovation and progress. And that lawlessness is the necessary context for technological innovation. Schmidt, Page, and Brin have each been outspoken on these themes. In a 2010 interview with the Wall Street Journal, Schmidt insisted that Google needed no regulation because of strong incentives to treat its users right. In 2011, Schmidt cited former Intel CEO Andy Grove's anti-democratic formula to a Washington Post reporter, commenting that Grove's idea works for me. Google was determined to protect itself from the slow pace of democratic institutions. This is an Andy Grove formula. High tech runs 3 times faster than normal businesses, and the government runs 3 times slower than normal businesses. So we have a 9 times gap. And so what you want to do is you want to make sure that the government does not get in the way and slow things down. Business Insider covered Schmidt's remarks at the Mobile World Congress that same year, writing, "When asked about government regulation, Schmidt said that technology moves so fast that governments really shouldn't try to regulate it because it will change too fast, and any problem will be solved by technology. We'll move much faster than any government." Both Brin and Page are even more candid in their contempt for law and regulation. CEO Page surprised a convocation of developers in 2013 by responding to questions from the audience, commenting on the negativity that hampered the firm's freedom to build really great things and create interoperable technologies with other companies. "Old institutions like law and so on aren't keeping up with the rate of change that we've caused through technology. The laws when we went public were 50 years old. A law can't be right if it's 50 years old, like it's before the internet. When asked his thoughts on how to limit negativity and increase positivity, Page reflected, "Maybe we should set aside a small part of the world. As technologists, we should have some safe places where we can try out some new things and figure out what is the effect on society, what's the effect on people, without having to deploy kind of into the normal world." It is important to understand that surveillance capitalists are impelled to pursue lawlessness by the logic of their own creation. Google and Facebook vigorously lobby to kill online privacy protection, limit regulations, weaken or block privacy-enhancing legislation, and thwart every attempt to circumscribe their practices because such laws are existential threats to the frictionless flow of behavioral surplus. Extraction quarry must be both unprotected and available at zero cost if this logic of accumulation is to succeed. These requirements are also an Achilles heel. Code is law for Google now, but the risk of new laws in its established and anticipated territories remains a persistent danger to surveillance capitalism. If new laws were to outlaw extraction operations, the surveillance model would implode. This market form must either gird itself for perpetual conflict with the democratic process, or find new ways to infiltrate, seduce, and bend democracy to its ends if it is to fulfill its own inner logic. The survival and success of surveillance capitalism depend upon engineering collective agreement through all available means while simultaneously ignoring, evading, contesting, reshaping, or otherwise vanquishing laws that threaten free behavioral surplus. These claims to lawless space are remarkably similar to those of the robber barons of an earlier century. Like the men at Google, the late 19th century titans claimed undefended territory for their own interests, declared the righteousness of their self-authorizing prerogatives, and defended their new capitalism from democracy at any cost. At least in the U.S. case, we have been here before. Economic historians describe the dedication to lawlessness among the Gilded Age robber barons, for whom Herbert Spencer's social Darwinism played the same role that Hayek, Jensen, and even Ayn Rand play for today's digital barons. In the same way that surveillance capitalists excuse their corporations' unprecedented concentrations of information and wealth as the unavoidable result of network effects and winner-take-all markets, the Gilded Age industrialists cited Spencer's specious, pseudo-scientific survival of the fittest as proof of a divine plan intended to put society's wealth in the hands of its most aggressively competitive individuals. The Gilded Age millionaires, like today's surveillance capitalists, stood on the frontier of a vast discontinuity in the means of production, with nothing but blank territory in which to invent a new industrial capitalism, free from constraints on the use of labor, the nature of working conditions, the extent of environmental destruction, the sourcing of raw materials, or even the quality of their own products. And like their 21st century counterparts, they did not hesitate to exploit the very law that they despised. Flying the banner of private property and freedom of contract, much as surveillance capitalists march under the flag of freedom of speech as the justification for unobstructed technological progress, a topic to which we shall return. Imbued with the conviction that the state had neither right nor reason to interfere in the workings of the economy, the Gilded Age millionaires joined forces to defend the rights of capital and limit the role of elected representatives in setting policy or developing legislation. There was no need for law, they argued, when one had the law of evolution, the laws of capital, and the laws of industrial society. John Rockefeller insisted that his outsized oil fortune was the result of the natural law of trade development. Jay Gould, when questioned by Congress on the need for federal regulation of railroad rates, replied that rates were already regulated by the laws of supply and demand, production and consumption. The millionaires mobilized in 1896 to defeat the populist Democrat William Jennings Bryan, who had vowed to tether economic policy to the political realm, including regulating the railroads and protecting the people from robbery and oppression. The bottom line for Gilded Age business elites was that the most effective way to protect the original sin of that economic era was, as David Nassau put it, to circumscribe democracy. They did this by lavishly funding their own political candidates, as well as through the careful honing and aggressive dissemination of an ideological attack on the very notion of democracy's right to interfere in the economic realm. Their industries were to be self-regulating, free to follow their own evolutionary laws. Democracy, they preached, had its limits, beyond which voters and their elected representatives dared not trespass, lest economic calamity befall the nation. In our discussion of fortifications, we'll see that Google revived all of these strategies and more. But first, we explore the unique circumstances that sheltered the young company and protected its discovery of human experience as a limitless resource ripe for the taking. 3. Shelter, the neoliberal legacy. Google's leaders were also favored by historical circumstance. Both Google and the wider surveillance capitalist project were the beneficiaries of two developments that contributed to a uniquely sheltering habitat for the surveillance mutation. The first is the neoliberal capture of the governmental machinery for oversight and regulation of the U.S. economy, the framework of which we discussed in Chapter 2. A fascinating study by University of California law professor Jody Short empirically illustrates the role of neoliberal ideology as one important explanation for Google's ambitions and successful defense of lawless territory. Short analyzed 1,400 law review articles on the subject of regulation, all published between 1980 and 2005. As the influence of Hayek and Friedman predicts, the dominant theme of this literature was the coercive nature of administrative government and the systemic conflation of industry regulation with tyranny and authoritarianism. According to this worldview, all regulation is burdensome, and bureaucracy must be repudiated as a form of human domination. Short observes that during the sample decades, these fears were even more influential in shaping regulatory approaches than rational arguments about cost and efficiency, and she identifies two points of origin for these anxieties. The first source was in the U.S. business community's opposition to New Deal reforms, which, not unlike the propaganda of the Gilded Age millionaires, cast resistance to regulation as a righteous fight to defend democracy from dictatorship. A second source was the dread of totalitarianism and collectivism incited by World War II and the Cold War, a direct inheritance from Hayek. These defensive themes infiltrated and reshaped U.S. political thought, and they gradually transformed policymakers' assumptions about the regulatory role of the state. Short found several suggested remedies for coercive governmental regulation in the literature, but the most salient, especially after 1996, the very years when digital technology and the internet were becoming mainstream, was self-regulation. The idea here is that firms set their own standards, monitor their own compliance with those standards, and even judge their own conduct in order to voluntarily report and remediate violations. By the time of Google's public offering in 2004, self-regulation was fully enshrined within government and across the business community as the single most effective tool for regulation without coercion, and the antidote to any inclination toward collectivism and the centralization of power. This neoliberal legacy was a windfall for the new surveillance capitalists. As another legal scholar, Frank Pasquale, observed, it produced a model that treated privacy as a competitive good, assuming that consumers engage only with services that offer the level of privacy they seek. Regulatory interference, according to this view, would only undermine competitive diversity. It also credits the notice and consent model, click wrap and its sadistic relatives, as accurate signals of individual privacy choices. The neoliberal zeitgeist also favored Google's leaders, and later their fellow travelers in the surveillance project, as they sought shelter for their inventions beneath claims of First Amendment rights to freedom of expression. This is a complex and contested arena in which constitutional law and political ideology are thoroughly entangled, and I point out just a few elements here in order to better understand the habitat that nurtured the new surveillance market form. The key dynamic here is that First Amendment jurisprudence, especially over the last two decades, has reflected a conservative libertarian interpretation of First Amendment rights. As constitutional law scholar Stephen Hayman suggests, in recent decades, the First Amendment has become one of the most important means by which judges have sought to advance a conservative libertarian agenda. This has produced many dramatic judicial decisions, including the U.S. Supreme Court's rejection of any constraints on the role of money in election campaigns, its rejection of restrictions on hate speech and pornography, and its holding that the right to free association takes precedence over state civil rights laws that bar discrimination. As many legal scholars observe, the ideological orientation of contemporary First Amendment judicial reasoning asserts a close connection between free speech and property rights. The logic that links ownership to an absolute entitlement to freedom of expression has led to a privileging of corporate actions as speech deserving of constitutional protection. Some scholars regard this as a dangerous reversion to the feudal doctrines from which corporate law evolved in the 17th century. Those medieval legal principles limited the sovereign's authority over the corporations of aristocracy, church, guilds, universities, and cities, who asserted the right to rule themselves. One result is that U.S. courts have been quick to see the possibilities of governmental overreach, but much less willing to see the problems of private, let alone corporate, power. In this context, surveillance capitalists vigorously developed a cyber-libertarian ideology that Frank Pasquale describes as free speech fundamentalism. Their legal teams aggressively assert First Amendment principles to fend off any form of oversight or externally imposed constraints that either limit the content on their platforms or the algorithmic orderings of information produced by their machine operations. As one attorney who has represented many of the leading surveillance capitalists puts it, the lawyers working for these companies have business reasons for supporting free expression. Indeed, all of these companies talk about their businesses in the language of free speech. This is one respect in which the surveillance capitalists are not unprecedented. Adam Winkler, a historian of corporate rights, reminds us, "Throughout American history, the nation's most powerful corporations have persistently mobilized to use the Constitution to fight off unwanted government regulations." Although today's mobilizations are not original, Winkler's careful account demonstrates the effects of past mobilizations on the distribution of power and wealth in U.S. society and the strength of democratic values and principles in each era. The key point for our story in the age of surveillance capitalism is that the expansion of opportunities for free expression associated with the Internet has been an emancipatory force in many vital respects. But this fact must not blind us to another condition. Free speech fundamentalism has deflected careful scrutiny of the unprecedented operations that constitute the new market form and account for its spectacular success. The Constitution is exploited to shelter a range of novel practices that are anti-democratic in their aims and consequences, and fundamentally destructive of the enduring First Amendment values intended to protect the individual from abusive power. In the U.S., congressional statutes have played an equally, or perhaps even more important, role in sheltering surveillance capitalism from scrutiny. The most celebrated of these is a legislative statute known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which shields website owners from lawsuits and state prosecution for user-generated content. No provider or user of an interactive computer service, the statute reads, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. This is the regulatory framework that enables a site such as TripAdvisor to include negative hotel reviews and permits Twitter's aggressive trolls to roam free without either company being held to the standards of accountability that typically guide news organizations. Section 230 institutionalized the idea that websites are not publishers, but rather intermediaries. As one journalist put it, to sue an online platform over an obscene blog post would be like suing the New York Public Library for carrying a copy of Lolita. As we shall see, this reasoning collapses once surveillance capitalism enters the scene. Section 230's hands-off stance toward companies perfectly converged with the reigning ideology and practice of self-regulation, leaving the internet companies, and eventually the surveillance capitalists among them, free to do what they pleased. The statute was crafted in 1995, during the initial phase of the public internet. It aimed to clarify intermediaries' liability for the content on their websites and resolve a controversy created by two contradictory court decisions, both involving defamatory posts. In 1991, a court found that CompuServe was not liable for defamation because it had not reviewed the contents of a post before it appeared online. The court reasoned that CompuServe was comparable to a public library, bookstore, or newsstand, a distributor, not a publisher. 4 years later, in 1995, an early provider of web services called Prodigy was sued for a defamatory anonymous posting on one of its message boards. This time, a New York State court came to the opposite conclusion. The key problem, as the court saw it, was that Prodigy had exercised editorial control by moderating its message boards. The company established content guidelines and deleted posts that violated those standards. The court concluded that Prodigy was a publisher, not merely a distributor, because it had taken responsibility for the content on its site. Were the court's ruling to stand, internet companies would face a paradoxical no-win situation. The more an ISP tried to keep obscene or harmful material away from its users, the more it would be liable for that material. Internet companies faced a binary choice: free speech savior or shield for scoundrels. According to Senator Ron Wyden, Section 230 was intended to resolve that contradiction by encouraging internet companies to exercise some control over content without the risk of legal sanctions. The very first sentence of the statute mentions protection for Good Samaritan blocking and screening of offensive material. What Wyden and his colleagues could not have anticipated, and still do not grasp, is that the logic of this early controversy no longer holds. Neither CompuServe nor Prodigy was a surveillance capitalist, but many of today's internet intermediaries are committed to the pursuit of surveillance revenues. This fact fundamentally changes the relationship between the company and the content on its platforms, and it explains why surveillance capitalists cannot be compared to the New York Public Library as the neutral caretaker of Nabokov's venerated book. Far from it. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, content is a source of behavioral surplus, as is the behavior of the people who provide the content, as are their patterns of connection, communication, and mobility, their thoughts and feelings, and the metadata expressed in their emoticons, exclamation points, lists, contractions, and salutations. That book on the bookshelf, along with the records of anyone who may have touched it and when, their location, behavior, networks, and so on, is now the diamond mine ready for excavation and plunder to be rendered into behavioral data and fed to the machines on their way to product fabrication and sales. Section 230's protection of the intermediaries now functions as another bulwark that shelters this extractive surveillance capitalist operation from critical examination. There is nothing neutral about the surveillance intermediary now, as the extraction imperative and its demand for economies of scale in surplus supply mean that the surveillance capitalists must use every means to attract a never-ending tide of content to their shores. They no longer merely host content, but aggressively, secretly, and unilaterally extract value from that content. As we shall see in Chapter 18, economic imperatives require them to forego as few of these raw materials as possible. That means moderating only those extremes that threaten the volume and velocity of surplus by repelling users or attracting regulatory scrutiny. This is the reason that firms such as Facebook, Google, and Twitter have been reluctant to remove even the most egregious content from their landscapes, and it helps to explain why lawyers for tech companies litigate ferociously to prevent even a sliver of erosion in Section 230. A statute once crafted to nurture an important new technological milieu is now the legal bulwark that protects the asymmetric wealth, knowledge, and power of a rogue capitalism. 4. Shelter. Surveillance exceptionalism. In his book Surveillance After September 11th, surveillance scholar David Lyon writes that in the aftermath of the attacks that day, existing surveillance practices were intensified and previous limits were lifted. After several decades in which data protection officials, privacy watchdogs, civil rights groups, and others have tried to mitigate negative social effects of surveillance, we are witnessing a sharp tilt toward more exclusionary and intrusive surveillance practices. This abrupt refocusing of governmental power and policy after the 9/11 attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., is a second historical condition that lent shelter to the fledgling market form. Lyon's characterization is accurate. In the years before 9/11, the Federal Trade Commission emerged as the key actor defining the debate on internet privacy in the U.S. For reasons that we have already reviewed, the FTC favored self-regulation, and it cajoled internet companies to establish codes of conduct, privacy policies, and methods of enforcement. But the FTC eventually concluded that self-regulation would not be sufficient to protect individual consumers' privacy on the web. In 2000, still 1 year before the 9/11 attacks, Google's discovery of behavioral surplus, or the success of AdWords, a majority of FTC commissioners issued a report in which they recommended legislation to regulate online privacy. Because self-regulatory initiatives to date fall far short of broad-based implementation of self-regulatory programs. They wrote, "The Commission has concluded that such efforts alone cannot ensure that the online marketplace as a whole will follow the standards adopted by industry leaders, notwithstanding several years of industry and governmental effort." The report noted that a mere 8% of popular websites featured a seal of approval from one of the industry privacy watchdogs. The commissioners proceeded to outline federal legislation that would have protected consumers online despite the dominant bias against regulation and in favor of treating internet operations as free speech. The recommendations demanded clear and conspicuous notice of information practices, consumer choice over how personal information is used, access to all personal information, including rights to correct or delete, and enhanced security of personal information. Had these been translated into law, it is quite possible that many of the foundational elements of surveillance capitalism would have been either plainly illegal or at least subject to public examination and consent. The FTC effort was short-lived. According to Peter Swire, chief counselor for privacy in the Clinton administration, and later a member of President Obama's review group on intelligence and communication technologies, with the attacks of September 11, 2001, everything changed. The new focus was overwhelmingly on security rather than privacy. The privacy provisions debated just months earlier vanished from the conversation more or less overnight. In both the U.S. Congress and across the EU, legislation was quickly put in place that decisively expanded surveillance activities. The U.S. Congress passed the Patriot Act, created the terrorist screening program, and instituted a host of other measures that dramatically increased the warrantless collection of personal information. The events of 9/11 also triggered a steady stream of legislation that expanded the powers of intelligence and law enforcement agencies across Europe, including Germany, a country that had been highly sensitized to surveillance under the hammer of both Nazi and Stalinist totalitarianism, the UK, and France. In the US, the failure to connect the dots on the terrorist attack was a source of shame and dismay that overwhelmed other concerns. Policy guidelines shifted from need to know to need to share as agencies were urged to tear down walls and blend databases for comprehensive information and analysis. In a parallel development, privacy scholar Chris J. Hufnagel observes that the threat of comprehensive privacy legislation had also mobilized the business community and its lobbyists to either shape or stop any potential bill. In the post-9/11 political environment, the two forces converged for an easy victory. The internet was the critical target. CIA Director Michael Hayden conceded as much in 2013 when he told an audience that in the years following 9/11, the CIA could be fairly charged with the militarization of the World Wide Web. Legislation to regulate online privacy was an immediate casualty. Mark Rotenberg, the director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, testified to the 9/11 Commission on the sudden reversal of privacy concerns, observing that before 9/11, there was hardly any positive discussion about the development of techniques that would enable massive surveillance while attempting to safeguard privacy. Swire concurred, noting that as a result of the new emphasis on information sharing, Congress lost interest in regulating information usage in the private sector. Without the threat of legislation, the energy went out of many of the self-regulatory efforts that industry had created. At the FTC, the focus shifted from the broader concerns of privacy rights to a more politically palatable, harms-based strategy, pursuing cases in which concrete physical harms or economic injuries could be defined, such as identity theft or database security. With legislation off the table, other forces shaped the political environment in which surveillance capitalism would root and grow. The 9/11 terrorist attacks thrust the intelligence community into an unfamiliar demand curve that insisted on exponential increases in velocity. For all its secrecy, even the NSA was subject to the temporalities and legal restrictions of a democratic state. The tempos of democracy are slow by design, weighted by redundancies, checks and balances, laws and rules. The agencies sought methods of deployment that could rapidly bypass legal and bureaucratic restrictions. In this environment of trauma and anxiety, a state of exception was invoked to legitimate a new imperative: speed at any cost. As Lyon put it, what 9/11 did was to produce socially negative consequences that hitherto were the stuff of repressive regimes and dystopian novels. The suspension of normal conditions is justified with reference to the war on terrorism. Critical to our story is the fact that this state of exception favored Google's growth and the successful elaboration of its surveillance-based logic of accumulation. Google's mission was to organize and make accessible the world's information. And by late 2001, the intelligence community established information dominance in the public's house, quickly institutionalizing it in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of state-sponsored global technology infrastructure, personnel, and practice. The contours of a new interdependency between public and private agents of information dominance began to emerge, one that is best understood through the lens of what the sociologist Max Weber once called an elective affinity born of a mutual magnetism that originates in shared meanings, interests, and reciprocities. The elective affinity between public intelligence agencies and the fledgling surveillance capitalist Google blossomed in the heat of emergency to produce a unique historical deformity, surveillance exceptionalism. The 9/11 attacks transformed the government's interest in Google as practices that just hours earlier were careening toward legislative action were quickly recast as mission-critical necessities. Both institutions craved certainty and were determined to fulfill that craving in their respective domains at any price. These elective affinities sustained surveillance exceptionalism and contributed to the fertile habitat in which the surveillance capitalism mutation would be matured to prosperity. The elective affinity between public and private missions was evident as early as 2002, when former NSA Chief Admiral John Poindexter proposed his Total Information Awareness, TIA, program, with a vision that reads like an early guide to the foundational mechanisms of behavioral surplus capture and analysis. If terrorist organizations are going to plan and execute attacks against the United States, their people must engage in transactions, and they will leave signatures in this information space. We must be able to pick this signal out of the noise. The relevant information extracted from this data must be made available in large-scale repositories with enhanced semantic content for analysis to accomplish this task. As CIA Director George Tenet had declared in 1997, the CIA needs to swim in the valley, referring to the need to master the new technologies flowing from Silicon Valley. In 1999, it opened a CIA-funded venture firm in the Valley, InQtel, as a conduit for cutting-edge technologies. The operation was meant to be an agency experiment, but after 9/11, it became a critical source of new capabilities and relationships, including with Google. As Silicon Valley's Mercury News reported, there's a new urgency with the CIA to find technology that makes sense of all the unstructured data floating around on the internet and elsewhere. The agency can't train analysts quickly enough. InQtel's CEO described the government's agencies as scrambling and noted that we're in a state of hyperactivity now. Surveillance exceptionalism thrived in that hyperactivity. Poindexter's Total Information Awareness program did not obtain congressional support, but an analysis in the MIT Technology Review showed that many of the TIA initiatives were quietly reassigned to the Pentagon's Advanced Research and Development Activity, ARDA, which in 2002 received $64 million to fund a research program in novel intelligence from massive data. In 2004, the U.S. General Accounting Office surveyed 199 data mining projects across dozens of federal agencies, and more than 120 programs developed to collect and analyze personal data to predict individual behavior. The New York Times reported in 2006 that the intelligence agencies, backed by a $40 billion annual budget, regularly fielded secretive shopping expeditions to Silicon Valley in search of new data mining and analysis technologies. State security agencies sought ways to avail themselves of Google's rapidly developing capabilities and simultaneously use Google to further develop, commercialize, and diffuse security and surveillance technologies with proven intelligence value. If TIA could not be fully developed and integrated in Washington, parts of the job could be delegated to Silicon Valley and its standout in information dominance, Google. By late summer 2003, Google was awarded a $2.07 million contract to outfit the agency with Google search technology. According to documents obtained by Consumer Watchdog under the Freedom of Information Act, the NSA paid Google for a search appliance capable of searching 15 million documents in 24 languages. Google extended its services for another year at no cost in April 2004. In 2003, Google also began customizing its search engine under special contract with the CIA for its Intelink Management Office, overseeing top secret, secret, and sensitive but unclassified intranets for CIA and other IC agencies. Key agencies used Google systems to support an internal wiki called Intellipedia that allowed agents to share information across organizations as quickly as it was vacuumed up by the new systems. In 2004, Google acquired Keyhole, a satellite mapping company founded by John Henke, whose key venture backer was the CIA venture firm InQtel. Keyhole would become the backbone for Google Earth, and Henke would go on to lead Google Maps, including the controversial Street View project. In 2009, Google Ventures and InQtel both invested in a Boston-based startup, Recorded Future, that monitors every aspect of the web in real time in order to predict future events. Wired reported that it was the first time the CIA-backed venture firm and Google had funded the same startup, and that both firms had seats on Recorded Future's board of directors. In the decade that followed 9/11, surveillance exceptionalism was also expressed in the flattery of imitation, as the NSA tried to become more like Google, emulating and internalizing Google's capabilities in a variety of domains. In 2006, General Keith Alexander outlined his vision for a search tool called ICReach, that would allow unprecedented volumes of metadata to be shared and analyzed across the many agencies in the intelligence community. By late 2007, the program was piloted, boosting the number of communications events it shared from 50 billion to more than 850 billion. The system was designed with a Google-like search interface that enabled analysts to run searches against metadata selectors, and to extract vital behavioral surplus for analyses that could reveal social networks, patterns of life, and habits, and in general, predict future behavior. In 2007, two NSA analysts wrote an internal training manual on how to find information on the internet. It expressed the agency's keen interest in all things Google, with a detailed chapter devoted to a deconstruction of Google search and the Google hacks that can uncover information not intended for public distribution. That year, the elective affinities that infused the intelligence community's interest in Google were also highlighted when Google research director and AI expert Peter Norvig presented at a Pentagon Highlands Forum meeting, an exclusive networking event where military and intelligence officials commune with members of the high-tech industry, elected officials, elite academics, top corporate executives, and defense contractors. In 2001, the forum's director, Richard O'Neill, described its work to a Harvard audience as an idea engine. So the ideas that emerge from meetings are available for use by decision-makers as well as by people from the think tanks. It was to be a bridge between the government and commercial leaders, especially in Silicon Valley. According to one highly detailed account by investigative journalist Nafiz Ahmed and cited by legal scholar Marianne Franks, the forum was both a support system and an incubator of Google's growth, as well as a connecting and convening force for the Pentagon, intelligence agencies, and the young company. The U.S. intelligence community's incubation of Google from inception occurred through a combination of direct sponsorship and informal networks of financial influence, themselves closely aligned with Pentagon interests. Another legal scholar described the collaboration between Google and the intelligence community, especially the NSA, as unprecedented. During these years, scholars noted the growing interdependencies between the intelligence agencies, resentful of constitutional constraints on their prerogatives, and the Silicon Valley firms. The agencies craved the lawlessness that a firm such as Google enjoyed. In his 2008 essay, The Constitution in the National Surveillance State, law professor Jack Balkin observed that the Constitution inhibits government actors from high-velocity pursuit of their surveillance agenda, and this creates incentives for the government to rely on private enterprise to collect and generate information for it. Balkin noted that the Supreme Court has imposed few privacy restrictions on business records and information that people give to third parties. Email is typically held in private servers, making its protection limited, if not non-existent. This absence of law made private companies attract partners for government actors bound to democratic constraints. The government's need to evade constitutional oversight, argues legal scholar John Michaels, leads to secret public-private intelligence collaborations that tend to be orchestrated around handshakes rather than legal formalities such as search warrants, and may be arranged this way to evade oversight and, at times, to defy the law. He observed that intelligence agencies are irresistibly drawn to, and in some respects dependent upon, firms' privately held data resources. Both scholars' observations were confirmed in 2010 when former NSA Director Mike McConnell offered another glimpse into the elective affinities between Google and the intelligence community. Writing in the Washington Post, McConnell made clear that Google's surveillance-based operations in data capture, extraction, and analysis were both taken for granted and coveted. Here, the boundaries of private and public melt in the intense heat of new threats and their high-velocity demands that must be met in milliseconds. In McConnell's future, there is one seamless surveillance empire in which the requirements of self-preservation leave no opportunity for the amenities of democracy, with its time-wasting practices of due process, evidence, warrants, and law. As McConnell insisted, an effective partnership with the private sector must be formed so information can move quickly back and forth from public to private and classified to unclassified to protect the nation's critical infrastructure. Recent reports of possible partnership between Google and the government point to the kind of joint efforts and shared challenges that we are likely to see in the future. Such arrangements will muddy the waters between the traditional roles of the government and the private sector. Cyberspace knows no borders, and our defensive efforts must be similarly seamless. In the final months of the Obama administration, then-Secretary of Defense Ash Carter toured Silicon Valley, where he announced a new Defense Innovation Advisory Board meant to formalize a channel between the tech executives and the DoD. Carter appointed Schmidt to the new board and tasked him with selecting its members. As Wired concluded, "The government needs Silicon Valley more than ever as it seeks to defend from security threats in cyberspace." These facts are amply illustrated in a comprehensive treatment of bulk collection by an international group of scholars and edited by Indiana University's Fred Kate and Berkeley's James Dempsey. Kate and Dempsey note the expansive aggression of personal data in the hands of private companies. Governments understandably want access to this data. Essentially, every government in the world claims the power to compel disclosure of this data by the companies that hold it. Had it not been for surveillance exceptionalism, it is possible that these data would not even exist, at least not in their current volume and detail. Surveillance exceptionalism helped to shape the evolutionary course of information capitalism by creating an environment in which Google's budding surveillance practices were coveted rather than contested. Once again, history offers us no control groups, and we cannot know with certainty whether information capitalism might have developed in a different direction had it not been for the sudden new interest in surveillance capabilities. For now, it appears that one unanticipated consequence of this public-private elective affinity was that the fledgling practices of surveillance capitalism were allowed to root and grow with little regulatory or legislative challenge, emboldening Google's young leaders to insist on lawlessness as a natural right, and, in ways that are even more opaque, emboldening the state to grant them that freedom. Powerful elective affinities favored the acquisition of certainty at any price, and part of that price appears to have been the shelter of surveillance capitalism. In the fullness of time, historians will no doubt discover the specifics of these relationships and the ways in which Google's discoveries in the capture and use of behavioral surplus were sheltered from scrutiny, at least in part because of this new habitat of militarized demand. In the context of new military purpose, the digital capabilities that were aimed toward the advocacy-oriented values of the behavioral value reinvestment cycle flowed toward surveillance without impediment. Surveillance assets thrived without risk of sanction and attracted surveillance capital. Revenue followed. The situation recalls the auto, steel, and machine tool industries at mid-century when military orders kept plants operating at full capacity. In the end, however, this turned out to be more curse than blessing. Military demand distorted and suppressed the innovation process and drove a wedge between these industries and their civilian customers, leaving them vulnerable to foreign competitors in the globalizing markets of the late 1970s and early 1980s. Similarly, under the conditions of surveillance exceptionalism, Google's leaders were not compelled to undertake the arduous and risky work of inventing an exchange-based, advocacy-oriented market form when the surveillance model was so lucrative. Why risk experimentation with more organic paths to monetization when surveillance and extraction operations were safe from law and hugely profitable? Eventually, it wasn't just Google asking these questions. Every other internet business faced the same choices. Once surveillance revenues set the bar for venture capitalists and Wall Street analysts, it became that much easier for internet companies to go with the flow. Then it became onerous not to. 5. Fortifications. Why is it that so many years after the events that triggered the mania for information dominance, surveillance capitalism still runs with relatively little impediment, especially in the U.S.? The intervening years have seen the proliferation of thousands of institutional facts that normalized surveillance capitalism's practices and made them appear necessary and inevitable. The discovery of behavioral surplus and the massive accumulations of capital and material that followed, the proliferation of devices and services, the integration of data flows, and the institutionalization of futures markets in human behavior. This does not mean that we should succumb to the natural fallacy and interpret this flourishing as a signal of surveillance capitalism's inherent worthiness or inevitability. In the coming chapters, we will uncover many additional factors that have contributed to this success. But here, I want to focus on Google's proactive efforts to build fortifications around its supply chains in order to protect surplus flows from challenge. Although many elements of this fortification strategy have been well publicized, their importance for our story lies in the fact that each is one aspect of a multi-pronged effort that deflects scrutiny from core operations in order to maintain the flow of free, unregulated behavioral surplus. Fortifications have been erected in four key arenas to protect Google and eventually other surveillance capitalists from political interference and critique. 1. The demonstration of Google's unique capabilities as a source of competitive advantage in electoral politics. 2. A deliberate blurring of public and private interests through relationships and aggressive lobbying activities. 3. A revolving door of personnel who migrated between Google and the Obama administration, united by elective affinities during Google's crucial growth years of 2009 to 2016. And 4. Google's intentional campaign of influence over academic work and the larger cultural conversation so vital to policy formation, public opinion, and political perception. The results of these four arenas of defense contribute to an understanding of how surveillance capitalism's facts came to stand and why they continue to thrive. First, Google demonstrated that the same predictive knowledge derived from behavioral surplus that had made the surveillance capitalists wealthy could also help candidates win elections. To make the point, Google was ready to apply its magic to the red-hot core of 21st century campaigning, beginning with the 2008 Obama presidential campaign. Schmidt had a leading role in organizing teams and guiding the implementation of cutting-edge data strategies that would eclipse the traditional political arts with the science of behavioral prediction. Indeed, at Obama's Chicago headquarters, they remodeled the electorate in every battleground state each weekend. Field staff could see the event's impact on the projected behaviors and beliefs of every voter nationwide. Research by media scholars Daniel Kreese and Philip Howard indicates that the 2008 Obama campaign compiled significant data on more than 250 million Americans, including a vast array of online behavioral and relational data collected from use of the campaign's website and third-party social media sites such as Facebook. Journalist Sasha Eisenberg, who documented these developments in his book The Victory Lab, quotes one of Obama's 2008 political consultants, who likened predictive modeling to the tools of a fortune teller. "We knew who people were going to vote for before they decided." Obama used his proximity to Schmidt to cement his own identity as the innovation candidate poised to disrupt business as usual in Washington. Once elected, Schmidt joined the Transition Economic Advisory Board and appeared next to Obama at his first post-election press conference. According to Politico, the image alone of Schmidt standing elbow to elbow with Obama's top economic thinkers was enough to send shivers up the spine of Google's competitors. "This terrifies Microsoft," said a Democratic lobbyist familiar with the industry. "There's a reason why people are scared to death of Google." Schmidt's role in President Obama's election was but one chapter in a long and by now fabled relationship that some have described as a love affair. Not surprisingly, Schmidt took on an even more prominent role in the 2012 re-election campaign. He led in fundraising and in breaking new technical ground, and he personally oversaw the voter turnout system on election night. Political correspondent Jim Rutenberg's New York Times account of the data scientist's seminal role in the 2012 Obama victory offers a vivid picture of the capture and analysis of behavioral surplus as a political methodology. The campaign knew every single wavering voter in the country that it needed to persuade to vote for Obama by name, address, race, sex, and income, and it had figured out how to target its television ads to these individuals. One breakthrough was the persuasion score that identified how easily each undecided voter could be persuaded to vote for the Democratic candidate. The facts of behavioral surplus and its predictive power were kept top secret in the Obama campaigns, just as they are in Google, Facebook, and other domains of information dominance. As Rutenberg observed, the extent to which the campaign used the newest tech tools to look into people's lives and the sheer amount of personal data its vast servers were crunching remained largely shrouded. The secrecy was partly to maintain their competitive edge, but it was also, no doubt, because they worried that practices like data mining and analytics could make voters uncomfortable. Second, with the 2012 election in sight, an interview with the Washington Post in 2011 found Schmidt boasting about another fortification strategy. "The staffers are young. The staffers get it. So that's what we depend on. And of course, we've hired ex-staffers as well. They all know each other, so that's how it really works." Google's political utilities paved the way for the unusually crowded and fast-spinning revolving door between the East Coast and West Coast centers of power. The Google Transparency Project analyzed the movement of staff between the Google sphere, the company plus its affiliates and its laws and lobbying firms, and the government, including the White House, Congress, government agencies, federal commissions, and national political campaigns during the Obama years. It found that by April 2016, 197 individuals had migrated from the government into the Google sphere, and 61 had moved in the other direction. Among these, 22 White House officials went to work for Google, and 31 Google sphere executives joined the White House or federal advisory boards with direct relevance to Google's business. Third, just to be on the safe side, Google shared its largesse throughout the political system. In Schmidt's 2014 book, co-authored with longtime Google executive Jonathan Rosenberg, the CEO aggressively developed the theme of government as the shill of incumbents colluding to inhibit change, with Google on the outside, an upstart and a disruptor. The authors voiced their disdain for politicians and lobbyists, writing, "This is the natural path of politicians, since incumbents tend to have a lot more money than disruptors and are quite expert in using it to bend the political will of any democratic government." That same year, while Schmidt disparaged incumbents and their political sway, Google spent more on lobbying than any other corporation, over $17 million, and nearly twice as much as surveillance rival Facebook. In the next few years, as the White House changed hands, Google maintained its pace, outspending every other company with a more than $18 million lobbying outlay in 2018, as the company fended off privacy legislation and other initiatives that might impede its freedom to capture and process behavioral surplus. Google was also among the wealthiest of all registered lobbyists in the EU, second only to a lobbying group that represents a confederation of European corporations. The firm also learned to engineer sophisticated lobbying efforts at the state level, primarily geared to fight back any proposed legislation that would augment privacy and curtail behavioral surplus operations. For example, Google won the right to put its self-driving cars on the road, anticipated as important supply chains, after enlisting Obama officials to lobby state regulators for key legislation. Both Google and Facebook currently lead aggressive state-level lobbying campaigns aimed at repelling or weakening statutes to regulate biometric data and protect privacy. As one report put it, "They want your body." In the fourth arena of fortifications, the corporation learned to infiltrate and influence academic research and civil society advocacy in ways that softened or, in some cases, thwarted the examination of its practices. The Washington Post describes Google as a master of Washington influence and notes the subtlety with which the firm grasps and directs its own narrative. Schmidt was hands-on in this work as well. Already a board member of the New America Foundation, a public policy think tank that played an influential role in shaping the Obama administration's approach to economic issues, he assumed the chairmanship in 2013 with a personal donation of $1 million, a significant percentage of its $12.9 million annual budget that year. Between 1999 and 2016, when Schmidt left the board, the foundation received $21 million from a combination of Google, Schmidt, and Schmidt's family foundation. The Washington Post published an elaborate exposé of Google's meticulous work in this fourth domain, illustrated in the backstage intrigues that accompanied a three-part series on internet search competition held at George Mason University's Law and Economics Center, a free market-oriented academic center that had received significant funding from Google. The meetings occurred in May 2012, just as the FTC was investigating the Google antitrust case. Reporters found that company staffers worked closely with the center, choosing pro-Google speakers and participants, many of whom were Google employees. Their efforts included sending the center's staff a detailed spreadsheet listing members of Congress, FTC commissioners, and senior officials with the Justice Department and State Attorney General's office. Reporters noted that the conference's panels were dominated by leading technology and legal experts who forcefully rejected the need for government action against Google, making their arguments before some of the very regulators who would help determine its fate. Many participants had no idea that Google was involved in crafting the meetings, because Google and center staffers had agreed to conceal the corporation's backstage involvement. The FTC antitrust investigation appears to have heightened Google's fears of a regulatory threat to surveillance capitalism. That year, Google's grant-making operation aimed at civil society organizations took an aggressive turn. According to the Center for Media and Democracy's investigatory research report, The Googleization of the Far Right, the corporation's 2012 list of grantees featured a new group of anti-government groups known for their opposition to regulation and taxes and their support for climate change denial, including Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, the Koch brothers-funded Heritage Action, and other anti-regulatory groups such as the Federalist Society and the Cato Institute. The corporation also quietly acknowledged its membership in the corporate lobbying group ALEC, known for its opposition to gun control and emissions curbs, and for its support for voter suppression schemes, tobacco industry tax breaks, and other far-right causes. Meanwhile, a list of Google Policy Fellows for 2014 included individuals from a range of nonprofit organizations whom one would expect to be leading the fight against that corporation's concentrations of information and power, including the Center for Democracy and Technology, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Future of Privacy Forum, the National Consumers League, the Citizen Lab, and the Asociación por los Derechos Civiles. In July 2017, The Wall Street Journal reported that since 2009, Google had actively sought out and provided funding to university professors for research and policy papers that support Google's positions on matters related to law, regulation, competition, patents, and so forth. In many cases, Google weighed in on the papers before publication, and some of the authors did not disclose Google as a source of funding. Although Google publicly claimed that the check came with no requirements, another case in 2017 belied that notion. That summer, one of the New America Foundation's most highly regarded scholars and a specialist in digital monopolies, Barry Lynn, posted a statement praising the EU's historic decision to levy a $2.7 billion fine on Google as the result of a multi-year antitrust investigation. According to the New York Times and Lynn's own account, New America's director bent to pressure from Schmidt, firing Lynn and his open markets team of 10 researchers. Google is very aggressive in throwing its money around Washington and Brussels and then pulling strings, Lynn told the New York Times. People are so afraid of Google now. The reporters cite Google's muscular and sophisticated influence operation as surpassing any other U.S. companies. With Google in the lead, surveillance capitalism vastly expanded the market dynamic as it learned to expropriate human experience and translate it into coveted behavioral predictions. Google and this larger surveillance project have been birthed, sheltered, and nurtured to success by the historical conditions of their era, second modernity needs, the neoliberal inheritance, and the realpolitik of surveillance exceptionalism, as well as by their own purpose-built fortifications designed to protect supply chain operations from scrutiny through political and cultural capture. Surveillance capitalism's ability to keep democracy at bay produced these stark facts. Two men at Google who do not enjoy the legitimacy of the vote, democratic oversight, or the demands of shareholder governance exercise control over the organization and presentation of the world's information. One man at Facebook who does not enjoy the legitimacy of the vote, democratic oversight, or the demands of shareholder governance exercises control over an increasingly universal means of social connection, along with the information concealed in its networks.